Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, what did scientists discover inside a 2,000-year-old medicine chest found intact on an ancient shipwreck? And how do you find out if you're allergic to the food that's being served up in a restaurant? Luckily, there's a phone app that can diagnose if your dinner is safe or not. We'll find out how it works.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with us for this, the February 2013 edition of Chemistry World, are Bibiana Campaseo, Neil Withers and Laura Howes. Laura.
We all think of pharmacy and medicine as fairly, you know, new and cutting edge. It turns out that if you look at a shipwreck from 2,000 years ago, you can find out all about ancient pharmacy.
Go on.
So this is looking at a shipwreck called the Pizzino shipwreck, which was found off the coast of Tuscany in Italy, near an Etruscan harbour, from about 200 BC. And it was found in 1974 and excavated in the late 80s. But there's quite a lot of finds. They've only just been sort of really going through and evaluating everything that was there. And one of the things they found is what they think is a doctor's chest with lots of medicines and equipment.
Still intact?
Pretty much still intact. There were still cups and vessels, and there were also quite a lot of vials. And some of these vials were made of metal and pretty much hermetically sealed. So not only did you have the equipment, but you had some of the medicines that this doctor was presumably taking with him to use.
Uncontaminated?
Uncontaminated. This is the important thing. There was no seawater in it at all. It was exactly as it was.
How did they then examine those medicines?
So first of all, they actually just did a x-ray of the tin to see what they had, and they found these sort of 4 centimetre by 1 centimetre thick tablets. So they're not for swallowing.
Job swallowing that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, they're not for swallowing. They think that actually what these were, and there's historical reasons why you think this as well, that they were dried medicines that would then be made into a paste with water or wine or oil or something like that. And then what they were doing was doing quite a lot of analytical analysis to look at the inorganic compounds that were within these tablets. And what they found was that the majority of the tablets was a couple of zinc minerals, so smithsonite, which is a zinc carbonate, and also a zinc hydroxycarbonate. And obviously, just because it's the majority of the tablets doesn't mean that they're the active ingredient. But we also know that zinc compounds were used in historical medicine. There's Pliny the Elder, Galen, people like that actually talk about these compounds being used.
Because zinc does have an antibacterial effect, doesn't it?
Which was what I was going to say. Even today, zinc oxide and zinc minerals are used, for example, in bandages.
I suppose what it does is corroborate written records too, doesn't it? Because the ancient Greeks were quite good at writing things down, but actually corroborating what they said they were using with what the actual stuff is. This is the chemical proof as to what they were playing with.
Absolutely. And also, when they were writing things down, they weren't necessarily writing things down as we might do today by so-and-so micrograms of this, so-and-so milligrams of that. In fact, when I was talking to someone about this story, they sent me one of the recently discovered recipes written down on a papyrus from Egypt. And instead of writing down how much you want of, you know, weight-wise, they use monetary values. So it's so-and-so drachmas of this, so-and-so drachmas of that. So not only is it corroboration that what they say they were using, they were actually using, but it gives us a better idea of the amounts they were using, because we just had no idea.
Thanks, Laura. Well, something completely different, much more modern day. Bibi, we're talking about shipwrecks and things. Maybe the ship got sunk by someone with nefarious intent using weapons, but were this technology that you're going to talk about in existence, maybe we could find out who done it. Tell us more.
Yes. We're going to be talking about visual identification of gunshot residue in crime scene investigation, actually. So this is research that has been carried out by a group of researchers at the Universidade de Brasília in Brazil. And basically, it's about gunshot residue and how to analyze it. The current technique is scanning electron microscopy coupled with energy dispersive spectroscopy. It is very time consuming. You also need to have an adequate amount of sample to be able to carry out the analysis.
So how would you do this? You would go to a crime scene and swab some skin or the floor or something, looking for products that are emitted when the actual propellant in gun bullets goes off.
Yeah, exactly. And then you would have to go. You would have to take it to the lab and actually put your sample into the instrument. And you have the potential for false positives because you have the risk of environmental and occupational contamination. And that's not the only problem. The other problem as well is that lead-free ammunition is now coming into use. And with that, obviously, because you don't have lead in your sample and your techniques are based around the determination of lead, you run into trouble there. So what this group of researchers have proposed is the use of lanthanide tags. So they have mixed lanthanide compounds into zinc aluminate, and they have used that as a luminescent marker that they mix with the ammunition. And basically all you have to do is, once the gun has been fired, you shine ultraviolet radiation on the surfaces, whether it is the hands of the shooter or any other surface, the firearm, for example, and you actually see the colour developing there.
I wonder what James Bond would make of it. But why is that better than the current technique? Because surely this is equally capable of being contaminated from the environment, isn't it? Or are these things so vanishingly rare, these lanthanides, they wouldn't normally be in the environment, and therefore you wouldn't see fluorescence like this?
I don't think you would see fluorescence like this. I think this is quite a specific type of marker that you're adding to your ammunition. You also can do the analysis in situ as well. You don't need to prepare samples. And then obviously these markers as well, they have they are luminescent for 90 days or at least 90 days. So during that period, you can still carry out your experiments and you would get the positive there.
Given that the lanthanides are a reasonable group of chemicals, does this mean you could use a number of them or put a unique cocktail together so that if I'm a manufacturer of product X, I could put that unique combo into my ammunition? So then at a crime scene, you'd know what ammunition had been used.
Yes, you can actually produce different mixtures depending on who the manufacturer is or the use. So whether it is, for civilian use or military or anything like that. So actually you've got a lot of information there in terms of ammunition traceability and origin.
Or ammunition for a legal case, I suppose you might say. Thanks, Bibi. And now to a growing online trend, which is the concept of crowdsourcing. This is where you harness the collective power of the online community to solve difficult problems or raise money. One of the early pioneers in this area, producing a web-based tool that generated huge numbers of candidate drug molecules, was Oxford's Graham Richards.
I'm quite good at pinching other people's ideas, and the first thing in this area was a project called SETI, which is the acronym Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which was set up by some very bright guys at Berkeley. And the problem they tried to solve was that on the Earth, we are constantly bombarded from all directions by radio signals from outer space. And these can be recorded and looked at to see if they're just noise or, in fact, an intelligent signal, and an ET is out somewhere in space sending a signal. The problem that they had, there are millions and millions of these signals all the time, and probably they mean nothing. And they hit on the idea of recording these, sending them out over the internet, and getting a piece of software in a screensaver to analyze them. It's a very clever computing idea, but in fact it hasn't ever produced a result because ET is yet to ring in. But tens of millions of people have done this over the years. I rather stole that idea to do something which would produce a result. We had protein targets that were likely to be drug targets, and we sent out molecules over the internet and the software to analyze whether they, each individual little molecule bound to the protein, was calculated on people's individual PCs. And the big difference between my project and the SETI project is that every compound we sent out produced a result which had to come back. So there's a lot more data handling to go with it.
And did you get any positive hits from the analysis of these small molecules?
And it was in some ways almost an embarrassment. It was so much more successful than we ever dreamed possible. So we got far more results than we could handle, and indeed far more even than a pharmaceutical company could handle.
But you haven't got a drug yet?
No, we haven't. I mean, that would take a long time. And it's also true to say, rather sadly, the early stage drug discovery business is not in very good shape at the moment. The pharmaceutical industry is in a bit of trouble, it has to be said. And so they're concentrating their efforts on the later stages.
Now, you got started in the relatively early days of this.
Indeed,
problem
yeah.
is lots of people are now jumping on this bandwagon. So does this mean that the successes that you have had, that SETI have had, that IBM get with their grid, people are going to get sort of crowdfunding fatigue, if you like, and they're going to lose the enthusiasm for it? And this means that projects that are very valuable, that may come along and exploit this as a vehicle in future, won't be able to.
I think it is going to get harder. It's going to be split down into a lot more small projects. But the sheer power of computers means that that is less of a problem than it used to be. Many of the things that we did involving, as I said, millions of computers, you could now do on the cloud much more easily. So the computer power goes up. So even if you've got less people involved, you can get more done.
Now, one thing I did want to ask you about was another aspect of this, which is that increasingly we're seeing crowdsourcing type projects where people pitch their ideas at the online community and the online community vote with their mouse button and open their wallet and say, well, I'll get behind this to the tune of £10 or whatever for that. In fact, we had David Braben on an edition of The Naked Scientist before Christmas. He's seeking to produce the next blockbuster computer program in exactly this way. There's no risk to him in the sense that if he's already raised all the funding to write it, he knows he's met his costs. So is research likely to go down the same sort of pathway?
The answer is yes. If you have a good idea, the internet is a wonderful way of getting this looked at by people. I think the medical research charities, for instance, find this quite an attractive field in which to expand their interest.
It's dangerous, though, isn't it? Because in the sense that if you have got something that tugs at people's heartstrings, you're going to find it much easier to separate people from their money than if you say, I'm a chemist who's very interested in this particular class of molecules, and academically this is a very valid project. It may have future spin-offs and translations, but not acutely. You're going to lose out to the person who says, my project's got both health and wealth and heart attached to it, and so people will go for that one.
Yeah, once again, I agree entirely with the Screensaver project. Although it was passive, I did get many thousands of emails from people saying, my mother has just been diagnosed with breast cancer and I think your project is the most wonderful thing because I think I'm doing something positive and not just giving money. And it was quite clear that the cancer aspect of it is what brought people in. And if I was just trying to produce a novel packaging which might do the environment a lot of good, it would be much harder to attract people to join.
So finish us off here by telling us what we should do to do this better next time. If you could do this all over again, what would you do next time? Where do you think the next generation of these things lies?
In my game of trying to develop novel drug leads, it would have to be adapted somehow to produce enough income to get chemists to synthesize the molecules that look good and to get them screened before they could be unlicensed. And in fact, we are thinking about something along these lines at this very moment.
Graham Richards. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how scientists reconstruct what the climate was doing thousands of years ago and why the kilo is gaining weight. But before that, Neil, please tell us, what is a super omniphobic material?
A super omniphobic surface is able to repel oil and water. You've probably seen in the last, 10 or 15 years, a lot of super hydrophobic materials that can repel water incredibly well.
So how do they work? And what's the difference between them and an omniphobic or super omniphobic material?
Okay, so most of those work, you kind of either have chemical ones or physical ones, and the physical ones is all about the structure. So that's your lotus leaf kind of kind of things where you have tiny microscopic hairs on a surface and they keep the water away from the actual surface itself. Or chemical ones, you have a chemical that doesn't interact well with water. So super omniphobic surfaces repel both oils and water, and those are just made of surfaces that are super repellent. It's a really complicated shape and are made of chemicals that are repellent to both. Or in some cases, even I think I've seen them where they have a structure with something that repels one, and then there's a liquid layer kind of in between that repels the other one.
So what is this story?
So the surface that I'm talking about now, that's been developed by scientists at the University of Michigan, doesn't just repel water and oil, but it also repels non-Newtonian fluids, things like custard, gravy and ketchup.
The classic cornflour,
which are all these things. I notice are all things that I regularly spill on my clothes and my ties and things, so I'd be happy to use this kind of thing. So what Anish Tuteja and his colleagues at the University of Michigan have done is create a super omniphobic surface that, as well as repelling water and oil, like the other ones do, it also repels non-Newtonian fluids, like custard, ketchup, gravy, the classic cornflour mix that we've all seen jumping around on speakers. And those are very difficult to repel normally because they have those strange properties where, as they move and get deformed, their properties change. So if you can imagine the droplet I was talking about before, if that starts to, the physical properties start to change as that gets moved about, then it suddenly becomes very difficult to repel.
Oh, I see. Because they behave as a liquid to start with, but as soon as the surface tries to push the liquid away, it then stiffens up.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
How does their one do it then? How do they get around that?
So their one is it's not hugely different to the others. It's, again, a combination of things. So the material is actually a kind of a lattice of stainless steel wires, very, very fine. And then it's coated with two different types of polymers, one a polydimethyl siloxane, which is a fairly well-used one, and a fluorinated version of that as well. But what's interesting about how the polymer is actually coated on the wires is it's coated in beads itself. So if you can imagine, these beads are highly rounded, so there's, again, a very small contact area. And the layer of air that it traps as well also contributes to this effect.
So why does that particular configuration mean that it can move custard off of your tie?
It's the tiny pockets of air that seem to do the job, because they prevent the acids and bases and the things in the liquid from actually reacting with the surface itself.
Could we actually use this practically, though? Because you're saying it's stainless steel and stuff like that. So could you coat things in this practically?
I guess you wouldn't necessarily coat them in the stainless steel. I think you would make the whole material out of stainless steel. So, and I think the particular applications that are more important than your tie are for clinical operations in hospitals, where you really don't want to get anything contaminated with materials.
Well, thanks for that, Neil. Still in the health sphere, but to something slightly different. You're out having dinner and you're not sure if you're going to throw up were you to eat the lunch, because you might be allergic to it. But Bibi, you may have the answer to this one.
Yes. We've talked about research carried out by this group before, because they had designed a mobile phone app to detect bacteria like Escherichia coli. And they have now actually adapted this technology to detect allergens in foods.
First of all, remind us who's done this.
The device has been developed by Aidogan Oskan from the University of California in Los Angeles to design what they call the iTube. And basically, it is a compact, lightweight, it's about 40 grams only, attachment that goes on the camera unit of your mobile phone. You use this to image tubes containing food sample and your control. You have a couple of light emitting diodes there. And basically what you're doing, you are running a colorimetric assay that looks at the intensity of absorption of light. And we all know how that works. So basically, you have an app running on your phone as well, which basically connects to the camera, and you get a positive or negative answer.
So you take a spoonful of food, you put it in this tube, and it extracts whatever the allergen it's been chosen to look for out of the food, if it's there, shines light through it, and if a certain wavelength comes up on the phone's own built-in camera, it can flash up a thing saying, don't eat this, there's gluten in there or something.
Yes, absolutely. Not only tells you that there is gluten there, but it tells you how much as well. But
I can't see that going down very well at a dinner party. So don't eat anything, everybody. Just running my iTube to see if the food's going to make me ill.
Yes. Unfortunately, you would have to wait for a little bit. But then once you've done your sample preparation and you've got your tubes in, the detection is very quick. It should take just a matter of seconds. And then obviously personal health and safety is the most important thing. So
since it's also on a mobile, does this mean it's sort of linked up to Facebook or whatever? I mean, social networking. Can you sort of tether it to GPS so it can sort of tag up? I ate here and I got loads of gluten, or got loads of egg protein in my food here. So you can either remember yourself or share it with your friends, so they have equivalent allergies. So people know where to go or where not to go.
You actually have the option of pulling all that data onto servers that allow you to draw allergen maps. So whether it is for your own personal use or to actually put on the web, all that information will be available there, and you will be able to see how you got poisoned and where. So, if that is the case.
And the name for that device? Well, it's got to be called the Appetite, of course. Thanks, Bibi. When climate scientists talk about reconstructing the conditions on Earth thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of years ago, how do they do it? One way is to look at the ice, which has been laid down in Antarctica.
I'm Professor Eric Wolfe from the British Antarctic Survey, and I work on studying ice cores. Well, the aim of the work is to understand how climate has changed over thousands, up to hundreds of thousands of years, as we've gone in and out of ice age cycles, as natural causes have changed the climate, so that we can learn more about how climate might change in the future. And we do that by measuring things, in my case, in ice cores, that tell us about the climate, but they don't tell us very directly about the climate. So the biggest problem is to understand how to translate what we measure in an ice core into something really useful about the climate.
What sorts of measures can you use to try and work out what the weather was like and what the climate was like millions of years ago?
Well, there are one or two things that are really simple. So the first one is measuring gases in the air bubbles that get trapped in the ice. And there we actually are essentially opening a bubble of ancient air and measuring the concentrations in it. So that's really nice and direct. It's not easy to do, but it's nice and direct. But the thing we'd really like to know about, of course, is the temperature. And it's correct that nothing actually records directly the temperature of the Earth, even at a single spot, let alone the global temperature, which is what we'd like to know. In ice cores, what we have is the isotopic ratios of the water molecules in the ice, and they do tell us about the temperature, but in a slightly indirect way, so we really have to tease out the information from that.
So what are you actually doing with the ice core in order to try to work out what the temperature was, where that ice was laid down, and then more broadly across the rest of the world?
So for measuring the temperature from an ice core, what we do is to measure the what we call the oxygen isotope ratio or the hydrogen isotope ratio, either will do, of the water molecules. So this is really the water molecules that make up the snow that turns into ice. And most of that water is H2-16O, so that's oxygen with an atomic mass of 16. But a small proportion of it is H2-18O, that's slightly heavier water. And that ratio changes according to the way that the water evaporates and condenses as it travels from the ocean towards our ice core site. And it turns out that in the very simplest situation, you can show analytically that the temperature at the ice core site is reflected in the oxygen isotope ratio rather directly. The difficulty is that in real life, you don't just get a single air mass traveling from the tropics towards the polar regions. You get many, many air masses. Sometimes it snows, sometimes it doesn't, and so on. And so the end result is that even the mean annual temperature at the site is a much more complex relationship with the oxygen isotopes than we would like, and you can only really get at it with a combination of analytical understanding and global circulation modelling.
Yes, I was going to say, how do you know, or how do you validate the data you get from the ice cores and say, well, we know that this maps onto a temperature in location X at the same sort of time or with a certain lag or latency, so that you actually can validate the model?
The way that it used to be done was not very satisfactory. What we used to do was to do a spatial survey of a part of Antarctica which had a wide range of temperature, and you can measure the oxygen isotope values in the surface snow across this area, compare it with the temperature which you could measure at the time, and you did find a good relationship, and that's fine. The only problem with that is that doesn't tell you that as the whole system changes with time, you'll get the same relationship. There are various ways that you can calibrate this, but none of them are ideal. One is to just calibrate that, you know, you've got maybe 50 years of a temperature record from a particular site, and you can compare your oxygen isotope ratios with that. That's not very good because the year-to-year temperature variations tend to be a bit stochastic. It's really not a very good relationship on a year-to-year level, and that's not what you're actually trying to understand. So there are other ways, one of which is to do with modelling, and the other one to do with measuring other things in the ice core or borehole that tell you about the temperature, but not at the same high resolution.
How far back can you go using ice?
We can go back in Antarctica 800,000 years so far. We think we should be able to go back a little bit further, and there's a project underway to work out where we could get back beyond 1 million years. In Greenland so far, we've gone back 128,000 years, and that's probably about the limit. The difficulty is not that there wasn't ice before that. There was. The difficulty is that in the places where the ice is thickest, and therefore you would think oldest, it tends to be melting at the bottom, so the oldest layers are being melted off.
Many people would say that the Earth is much older than measured in millions of years. The Earth's age is measured in billions of years. So is there anything we can do to go back further?
We'd very much like to go back further. Ice cores, unfortunately, won't take us back much further. I'd be very surprised if we could get beyond 1.5 million years. So to go back further, you have to use other proxies. And as an example, measuring carbon dioxide in ice cores is very direct. You can measure it in the air bubbles. And that gives us a beautiful record of CO2 over the last 800,000 years. Beyond that, you can use marine sediments with various proxies, one of which is boron isotopes. And by comparing those boron isotopes in marine sediments over the last 800,000 years with the ice core data, we can check that we do actually know what we're doing with the marine sediments and then take them back further.
So what is all this revealing to you?
Well, ice cores are giving us the best story that we have of what's happened to the atmosphere over time periods when natural climate processes have made quite significant changes to our climate. Ice ages have come and gone several times in 800,000 years. And you can see the interplay between the greenhouse gases, which are revealed by measuring carbon dioxide and methane in the ice, things like volcanism, which you can see from sulfate in the ice, and the climate. Of course, it's only the climate in the polar regions where we're measuring it, so you need the data from marine sediments, lake sediments, corals and so on to complete the picture of what was happening to global climate. But we are now starting to have not just a very vague conceptual model of how ice ages come and go, which is what I was taught when I was a student, but we're now starting to really understand the processes that occur, what all the different feedbacks are. And of course, the critical point about that is that those are the feedbacks that are going to determine whether putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in this century is going to cause a small climate change or a disastrous one.
Eric Wolfe. And now to a more environmentally friendly way to turn alcohols into acids. Neil.
So many of us will remember from school and maybe early university, the way to make carboxylic acids from alcohols is you have to use a pretty strong oxidising agent like...
Oh, dichromate.
Like dichromate,
potassium,
yeah.
Dichromate, I love that stuff.
Potassium,
I like the colour, actually.
Yeah. Well, there's that one, permanganate, which are both very...
They're not very nice, though. They have a big cross on the bottle, if I remember.
Yeah, they're both very strong oxidising agents.
Probably
which
banned
is why
in school
dangerous.
Now. Yeah.
I don't know, they might not be, so long as you're careful.
Yep, all right, so harsh conditions to oxidise alcohols, so the COH group becomes C double bond O, OH.
That's
right. Carboxylic acid.
Yep, you've got to get that extra oxygen in there somewhere. And so where that extra oxygen comes from, in the case of what you learn at school, is from the chromate and the permanganate. You remember those formulas with MnO3 and all that oxygen in there.
So they're literally the donor. So it's very, very consumptive because you're consuming one of those for every oxygen you're adding to the molecule.
Absolutely. So it's what we call a stoichiometric reaction. It takes one of those chromate or permanganates to make one alcohol into one acid. It's not catalytic. So what David Milstein and his colleagues at the Weizmann Institute in Israel have done is they've produced a catalyst, a ruthenium catalyst, which uses the oxygen from water as the oxygen source to make the carboxylic acid.
Still pretty energy intensive, I would think, though, isn't it? Because you've got to break the bonds in the water molecule to get the oxygen off. So does it still not require quite nasty conditions?
It requires basic conditions and some heat. So it's not room temperature, but compared to previous ones, it is pretty mild because you're not using the harsh oxidizing environment.
So what's the ruthenium doing?
So the ruthenium is in the form of a pincer complex. So it's got two pyridine ligands kind of pinching it, as if you can imagine between your finger and thumb, which holds onto the ruthenium. And this kind of grabs onto the alcohol, grabs onto the oxygen from the base, sticks them together, and out comes not quite the carboxylic acid, but a carboxylic acid salt. So it's got a cation attached, and you just change that into the acid later down the line.
Ruthenium's not cheap, though, is it?
It is a precious metal, but it's one of the cheaper ones of that class. It's not as expensive as platinum or palladium. And, of course, the crucial thing is it's a catalyst, so it isn't used up in the reaction. It's only used at the 0.2 mole percent, so it produces many, many, many more moles of carboxylic acid than it has it of itself.
Will it produce any kind of carboxylic acid that you want, or is this reaction restricted to certain molecules of certain sizes or certain types?
Well, that is often a problem with these kind of newly reported reactions, is they don't work on so many things. But this works on a whole range of primary alcohols, so it works on quite a large substrate range. And another interesting thing is it also, one of the sort of side products it produces is pure hydrogen. So you can imagine that if you're in a large chemical plant, then you can separate the stream of hydrogen gas that comes off. You can use that in other reactions, or you can just burn it for fuel to heat the reaction itself.
Terrific. Well, we're talking about sort of saving weight, saving energy and things like that. The kilo, Laura, has been gaining weight over the years.
Yes, like us all, as the years...
Well, I didn't like to say it.
I'll admit
it. I'm too polite for that. So go on, why is the kilo getting heavier?
We've been harking back to school lessons. We'll hark back again. I remember learning in, I think it was physics rather than chemistry, all about the standard weights and measures that were put in a vault in Paris, in France. So once the kilogram was decided upon, this is the kilogram to be all kilograms, they made a international prototype kilogram, which is a large cylinder of, well, not actually that large, a cylinder of platinum and iridium. And it's been stored in a vault in Paris, and it's been sitting there being the standard kilogram that all other kilograms are based on.
They made some copies of it, didn't they, which were then distributed around the world for individual countries to use as their kilo, so they had a reference.
Absolutely, and actually this is where our story starts to take a little turn. About 40 equivalents were made and sent around the country so that the one in Paris could stay standard, and these 40 replicas would then refer back to that one. And obviously, every so often you want to check that nothing's gone wrong and no one's, you know, chipped a bit off the corner of one. So you bring them back together and you weigh them to make sure they all weigh the same. And that's the point where they realised that all the weights were slightly different.
And this wasn't an artefact of the way they were made to start with. This is a new trait, is it?
This is a new trait. This could be a variety of reasons. For some of them, they've got lighter. Maybe they got polished a bit. Maybe they had some gas absorbed in them and that's been let off. The ones that have gained weight, that's through absorbing some other molecules from the air. So things like mercury contamination, also any kind of organics that are in the air can come. And if you think about the metals that are being used, they can start to form nice sort of carbaceous layers on the top.
So you get a skin which is making them heavier. Is it making them heavier by very much? It doesn't sound like it could.
Oh, it's tiny, tiny amounts. I mean, they're all less than about 100 micrograms.
So what's their solution then to fix this? Or can we not fix it?
Well, Peter Compson, who's at Newcastle University, has been thinking about this. And obviously, also, if you think about high-value metals, which, as we've been talking about, platinum, then actually if you're losing bits through having to scrub off the layer and then you remove some of the metal as well, then obviously that's a problem. So you need a way of cleaning the metal without losing any of the metal ions. So what he's been looking at is basically it's a bit like a chemical peel. He's washed it with some methanol and some water. So now when I say he's washed it, at the moment he's been working on model systems, so he hasn't touched the prototype kilogram yet, we should make that clear. But he's been making metal foils dirty and then washing them with some methanol and some water to remove the large amounts. And then he's put ozone in there, so that's a lot of O3, and UV light. And that creates lots and lots of free radicals that can then start to remove all of this sort of carbon layer and things.
Won't deal with the mercury you mentioned though, will it?
No, it won't deal with the mercury. So there are still some issues to this, but this might all become academic in a while anyway. They are looking at redefining the kilogram. If you think about all the other standard units that we have, things like the metre, that used to be also a metre-long piece of metal in a vault in France. And then they decided that actually it would be better if they defined the metre to a constant, and in that case it's the speed of light. So the metre is now the time that a photon, you know, the distance a photon travels in a very small amount of time. So the idea is that instead of defining your kilogram by a large lump of metal, you'll actually define it by the Planck constant, which is another constant. Therefore, that's the one thing that we haven't defined by a constant before.
Talking of trivial things, what have you got for us this month, Neil?
Okay, so my question for you this month is, what is the only material to which a gecko's foot cannot stick?
I'm torn between two possible answers. One, itself. The other, Tony Blair. He's pretty slippery.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment. But the actual answer is Teflon. So Teflon is so non-stick that a gecko can't stick to it. Can't
Has someone done
it.
The experiment? Have they put a gecko on a frying pan and seen if it jumps out?
It depends how hot the frying pan is, I guess, if it jumps out. But you can imagine the experiment of different angles of frying pan and how the gecko gets on.
And on that slippery note, we must bid you farewell for this month. Thank you to our Chemistry World team, Neil Withers, Laura Howes and Bibiana Campaseo, and our guests, Eric Wolfe and Graham Richards. The production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. We're back reacting to more cutting-edge chemistry next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.